This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rainn Wilson, is best known for his role on NBC's The Office as Dwight Schrute, the arrogant, authoritarian, and really odd assistant to the regional manager. He played another odd character in 6 Feet Under when he portrayed the intern at the Fisher family's funeral home. Wilson has the starring role in the new movie The Rocker. It opens August 20th. The movie begins in the 1980s when his character Fish is a drummer in a heavy metal band and gets replaced just before the band makes it big. Fish spends the next 20 years in an office job, seething with resentment. He picks up his sticks again when his nephew's band, ADD, needs a drummer, and out of desperation, they ask Fish to sit in for one night at their gig playing their high school prom. Eventually, Fish joins the band and tries to teach the members how to perform and how to behave as crudely as his old band did. But these antics seem hopelessly out of date to these young would-be indie rockers. Early in the film, Fish promises that he'll be able to get his nephew's band a gig. In this scene, he walks into the garage where the other three band members are rehearsing.
I have news. But you know what? Before I reveal said news, we need to work on some things, including stage presence. Why? Because ADD has a gig.
What?
What?
A gig?
Yes!
We are playing the Tiger Room in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Saturday night.
Oh, Indiana.
My mom's not going to let me go to Indiana.
No, my mom's not going to let me go.
Listen up, kiddies. Either. You think the Beatles went to their moms and dads and went, "Oh, hello, Mum. Hello, Dad. May I please have permission to go with my mates to a little pub called Shea Stadium and rock the world for the rest of eternity?" No!
They were adults. You're an adult. They were adults.
You don't ask your parents for permission to rock.
Rainn Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. So did you ever have any, like, heavy metal aspirations when you were younger?
Well, growing up in suburban Seattle, we were force-fed classic rock. That's all anyone listened to. If you didn't listen to classic rock, you were pummeled. I was pummeled, but I still listened to classic rock. So, you know, I was into early, I guess you would call it classic metal, you know, Sabbath and Zeppelin and AC/DC. As soon as things started to get to poodle metal, hair metal, in the mid-80s, it completely lost me. By that point, I had discovered punk rock and new wave, and I was gone off that tangent. So I skipped that whole era in rock and roll.
Did you do the heavy metal moves in front of the mirror? Did you have that period?
Not heavy metal moves. I was a geek in every way, shape, and form, and even in listening to classic rock, you know, I was drawn to, like, even the geekiest classic rock bands, like ELO and Queen. Those were my favorite ones. And I did a lot of Freddie Mercury moves. I saw there was some kind of Freddie Mercury concert broadcast in the 70s or something. I just thought it was just a remarkable force of nature, and I would prance around like Freddie Mercury in my, you know, in our condo in Lake Forest Park, Washington.
So what did you look at? What did you, like, really study for your role as the drummer in The Rocker?
Well, the first thing that happened when the movie got greenlit is a drum set showed up at my house and was moved into my garage. And the very next day, a drum coach showed up, this great guy named Stuart Johnson. He's a former heavy metal drummer himself. The art of heavy metal drumming is very different than any other kind of drumming. I mean, it's the showmanship. It's stick tricks and, you know, finding the hottest girls to set up with the lead singer and cueing pyrotechnics and spinning around on your throne and adding flames and sparks to the mix. So we worked on a lot of that stuff. And I quickly realized, like, wait a minute here. Stick tricks is actually going to make me look much more like a drummer than actual drumming in the movie, too. So I really worked on that. For weeks, I worked on that spin, you know, spinning the stick in between your fingers.
And throwing the stick into the audience.
Yes. You've got to do the stick tosses as well, and it's like juggling.
And every move has to be, like, 17 times larger than it really needs to be to make the sound you need.
Absolutely. Yeah. I say that heavy metal drummers are like the Las Vegas magicians of drumming.
Part of what the movie is about is how what's really cool when you're a teenager kind of ceases to be cool by the time you're in your 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the music that you thought was so cool kind of isn't now. The music's changed. But you're still kind of caught in what was cool when you were a teenager. Has that kind of thing ever really happened to you, or something that you really kind of worshipped and thought was, like, the the best thing in the world when you were a teenager just got really dated.
That's funny. Well, the first thing that just popped into my head was the whole world of Dungeons and Dragons. In my teenage years, I loved, you know, those kind of role-playing games and war games and Dungeons and Dragons and multi-sided dice and just that whole world of the imagination. You know, nowadays, you know, I still know some people that, and some of my old friends still play, and I still hear about games. Like, you know, someone will come up to me in Hollywood at a party, and they'll be like, "Hey, you know, I hear you used to be a gamer because we got a Thursday night D&D game. You got to come join us." And it's just like there's not enough hours in the week. You know what I mean? It's a perfect thing for adolescents to do. But now, you know, I got a wife and a kid and a career and I'm trying to write and play some music and stuff like that. It's like I just don't have those 17 and a half hours per week to pretend that I'm a monk with a magic staff.
But the same kind of thing happens on the internet now.
That's true. Yeah, that I have friends that play that, all those online games. So.
And so does your character, Dwight Schrute,
yes.
In The Office.
The massive multiplayer online gaming.
You have to do a lot of pratfalls in The Rocker. I mean, there's a lot of like stunts and things like that. So physical comedy is, I guess, what I mean to say. Mm-hmm. So where did you learn to do that? Did you learn that kind of stuff in acting school?
Well, I think among all the different kinds of geeks that I was growing up, one of them that hasn't really been explored too much is I was a comedy geek. I was the kid who would find out Monty Python was playing on PBS at like midnight on Sunday, and I would sneak out of bed with my cassette tape recorder, put a 90-minute cassette in and hold it in front of the television and record – because remember, there's no TiVo, there's no DVDs, there's none of that stuff – and record whole Monty Python sketches. And I remember I did the same thing with Singin' in the Rain that was on. And I learned all the songs and the comedy bits from Singin' in the Rain and Marx Brothers movies. And I had a little cassette library in my room of all of these geeky comedy things. And I had them memorized. And I could do whole – I was that annoying guy that would go to the screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and recite it word, from beginning to end. So I guess what I'm saying is that I always had a deep love of weird comedy. And physical comedy is part of that. And nothing made me laugh more than Jerry Lewis when I was growing up. And him walking backwards into a swimming pool, I could just think about it and chortle like a little girl.
So I feel now I need to ask you for the entire list of types of nerd or geek that you were when you were young.
Bring it. Yeah. Bring it. So how about this?
What's the whole list?
Sample this, Terry Gross.
Yes.
Model United Nations nerd.
Really? You were a member?
International relations nerd. That was one of my passions. I loved that. I discovered Model United Nations, and I loved news and history. And you know, I'd read the newspaper when I was young, and oh my God, I would get to go to a school Model United Nations conference and pretend to be the man from Ghana. It's like I'm going to be from Ghana. What would the guy from Ghana want to do? You know, and we'd pass resolutions, and I was Nicaragua, and I was even the U.S., and I loved being the Arab countries. We would go to the University of Washington to the conferences, you know, over in the local Seattle, all the Model United Nations geeks. I swear there's a good movie in here. And we would hit on the girls, all like eight of them that would be at the entire conference. It was fun, you know, running around pretending to be an Arab nation and sticking it to the U.S. And that was fun.
Okay, so we got UN nerd, music nerd, comedy nerd.
Yes.
What else?
Well, we didn't go fully into the music nerd part of things, I don't think, did we?
Well, I happen to know you played bassoon.
Yes, I was a bassoonist.
Which is great. Some people don't even know what a bassoon sounds like. It's a great instrument.
It sounds a little like this. Something like that, I think.
It's a hard instrument, isn't it? Those reeds.
It's really hard. It's a double
reed.
Hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nothing, it's also a girl repellent. So all you aspiring bassoonists out there, throw down your bassoons and pick up electric guitars.
You have to suck on the reed for a while, right?
That's what she said. Not now. You're on fresh air.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rainn Wilson, and he stars in the new movie The Rocker as a rock drummer. And He is also Dwight Schrute in The Office. He was the intern Arthur in 6 Feet Under. He was the drugstore owner or manager in Juno. Owner or manager?
I don't even know.
Who knows?
Yeah. Rollo was his name. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about The Office a little bit. And let me ask you to describe Dwight.
Okay. That's a good one. Dwight is hard to put your finger on, and I've spent years trying to describe him in interviews. And that's one of the great things about our show and what the writers have done on our show is that, you know, a normal half-hour sitcom would have the office dweeb. And you'd basically, you know, he'd be there to be a dweeb. You know, he would just be wearing the polyester shirt and saying his dweeby things. But Dwight is so many things. You know what I mean? One of the things that Greg Daniels said to me early on.
And he's the creator of the American version.
Yes,
and
the showrunner
the
of our show, who's insanely brilliant. And all of us on The Office would follow him into battle because he's such a great guy. But Greg said, Dwight has an adolescent love of hierarchies. And to me, that phrase sums it all up. It's kind of all you need to know. And the other thing, so Dwight is a militant dweeb, ass kisser. Can you say ass kisser on Fresh Air? All right, good. And and then I love the fact that he's a. We discover later on that he's a beet farmer, and that makes total sense. Because you ever meet a farmer, they can't quite ever fit in society. They may try as hard as they want. They can play it cool. They can do whatever they want. They can't really fit into city life, no matter how much they try. They're just more in tune with the dirt and the tides and the seasons and the wolves than, you know, human interaction.
Well, you know, you mentioned that, you know, Greg Daniels told you that he has this, like, almost childish love of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of The Office, Dwight is the most loyal lieutenant imaginable to Michael, who's
yes.
the boss of this branch. But then he senses he can have that power. And it looks like Michael's going to leave, and he can become the new Michael. And then, you know, all bets are off. Like, you want that power for yourself.
Yes.
And you just become, like, such the commander as opposed to the lieutenant. Was that a change in character for you when that change happened to Dwight?
No, it wasn't. I think that and they're so canny, the writers on our show, because they're always creating new textures for me to play as Dwight. I mean, this last season was Dwight's heartbreak. You
right,
know,
yes,
with
Angela.
And that was a whole other side of Dwight that got to come out, you know, in season four. Sides of Dwight that no one had ever seen before. And that was what you're referring to is a period of time when Dwight was potentially trying to wrest control of the office from Michael. And I think it was a deadly combination. It wasn't in Dwight's nature to do that. He only did it when encouraged by his little lady Macbeth, Angela. So when Angela, the head accountant, whispered those thoughts of power into his ear, you know, much like Macbeth, Dwight tried to rise to the challenge.
They always blame the woman.
But as Pam on the show said, you know, I have a vacuum cleaner that could also run this office pretty well.
Well, I have to play a clip from The Office. This is a classic scene. It's Take Your Daughter to Work Day, and you're like at the head of what's almost like a little classroom, like all the daughters are sitting in chairs. And you're in front reading to them and playing your recorder or flutophone.
Recorder.
Recorder.
Yes, part of my music nerd heritage.
And Michael is at the door watching. So here's the scene.
That was Greensleeves, a traditional English ballad about the beheaded Anne Boleyn. And now, a very special treat, a book my grandmother used to read me when I was a kid. This is a very special story. It's called Struwelpeter by Heinrich Hoffmann from 1864. The great tall tailor always comes to little girls that suck their thumbs. Are you listening, Sasha? Right? And ere they dream what he's about, He takes his great sharp scissors out and then cuts their thumbs clean off.
Dwight,
here's
Dwight,
a photo.
What the hell are you reading?
These are cautionary tales for kids.
My grandma used to read them. No. The kids don't want to hear some weirdo book that your Nazi war criminal grandmother gave you.
What's a Nazi?
Nazi was a fascist movement from the 1930s.
Don't talk about Nazis in front of me.
You know what? They're going to have nightmares, so why don't you just shut it?
I was going to teach the children how to make corn husk dolls.
Why don't you just leave, okay?
Okay.
Bye, Mr. Poop.
All right. There goes Mr. Poop. Now, who likes Dane Cook?
I do.
Such a great scene.
Written by the great Mindy Kaling.
Oh, who's also a member of the cast.
Yes.
And that was my guest, Rainn Wilson, in a scene from The Office. And Rainn Wilson is now starring in the movie The Rocker. Your character, Dwight, is always so intense and so inappropriate, as he was in his choice of readings. You know, you auditioned for the part of Michael, of the boss of The Office, right? Before getting the part of Dwight. So what was your audition for the part of Michael like? This is the part that Steve Carell plays.
They keep wanting to put it on the DVD of my audition as Michael. I was terrible. It was awful. It was never meant to be. It was just one of those things that I just basically did my Ricky Gervais impersonation because I really didn't know what to do with the character.
And Ricky Gervais played the boss in the original
British English version. Yeah. And I knew I was hungering for Dwight, and I knew Dwight was the one that was right in my wheelhouse. I was like, oh, let me at this one. I got to get this guy. And I remember there was some monologue I was doing about how I could drink my own urine. And I was like, oh, I want to say that. I want to say that line so bad. So my Dwight audition, needless to say, was a lot better than my Michael Scott audition.
So what did you have to do as either?
Oh, well, it was a very arduous audition process. I was actually the very first person to audition for the show, period. I had a good relationship with the casting director, and I came in and did my terrible Michael, and then I really hit a home run with Dwight. And then I kept calling, like, what's happening? And they're auditioning people. They're auditioning Michaels and Jims and having a hard time finding Michaels and Jims. And it was like 3 or 4 months later, finally, they're like, okay, we're going to have callbacks. And the callback – normally, when you audition for a television show, they have these called network tests where they bring the actors literally into like a conference room at NBC or wherever, and they parade them in like show cattle one after another, and they do their three little scenes in front of the executives who either glower at them or laugh hyper-hysterically. But Greg, you know, because Greg created the show King of the Hill, which was very successful and in syndication, so as soon as someone's done that on television, they figure, well, this guy must know what he's doing. And fortunately, in our case, Greg does know what he's doing. But he secured our location for a weekend, and he brought in all the actors that were called back, and he basically cycled us in and out like a giant revolving door. We had to be prepared to stay there all day long, and he mixed and matched us in various ways, and we improvised with each other, and we did written scenes, and we'd get thrown new material, and then we'd have to go out and wait for a few hours. So it was this kind of wonderful process of kind of digging in and exploring the characters in order for them to arrive at their final casting decision. And then they brought their favorites to the network and showed them the tape of what they had shot with them.
Now, Jenna Fischer, who plays Pam, the receptionist on the show, was recently on our show.
Horrible woman.
Yes, she was so dull.
Isn't she awful? Yeah.
So I want to play you an excerpt of that interview in which she talked about you. So here's the excerpt of the interview with Jenna Fischer. Are there any scenes from The Office that were too funny to get through without laughing and you had to keep reshooting them?
Oh, so many. So many. You know what happens is I seem to every year get tickled by a new actor in a way where I cannot do a scene with them. And the first year was Rainn Wilson. You know, Pam and Dwight did not have a lot of interaction. And so anytime we did have a scene one-on-one, I just couldn't get through it. Rainn Wilson, he has this weird way that he stands where he pushes his pelvis and his gut sort of out.
So that's Jenna Fischer talking about you on The Office. So how did you start doing that as Dwight's way of standing? And he also, am I wrong in saying he's often standing a little too close to the person he's talking to?
Yes, he's not so good at interpersonal boundaries, and that includes standing that way. I don't know, you know, it's just like, You do. It's just what we do as actors, I think. You know, my haircut for Dwight was very important. It was very important to me that I have the least flattering haircut possible to my head, which I designed specifically. Thank you very much. The calculator wristwatch that I wear brings me no end of pleasure. I am so close to that wristwatch. I don't want anyone to ever touch it. It really reveals his character. And also the fact that he still wears a beeper, which is about 8 years after beepers have been completely discontinued, because probably has some number that someone might still have. But all of these things put together, and then it kind of comes into your body. And I think your job as the actor is to let these impulses flow through you and not stifle them. So if you have, you know, again, he has this love of hierarchies and this love of power. Well, he's going to assert his power with his pelvis, you know, maybe stand inappropriately close to someone. And it's kind of like an alpha male type of thing.
I first saw you on 6 Feet Under. And it was such a great role, such a great performance. You play this intern who's very odd and kind of lonely, like you're not like other people. Mm-hmm. You kind of live in the past through books, through classics, and you don't even fit in into this like funeral home that you're working in. Describe the character a little bit.
Yeah, Arthur Martin is a mortician intern who is homeschooled and moves in with the Fisher family of 6 Feet Under and develops a romance with the mother, played by Frances Conroy. And, I think you described him perfectly. I always fancied Arthur to be completely guileless, that his heart was completely open, and he didn't know irony or sarcasm. And I played him – I really wanted him to just be a child in the world in a way, but the only way that he could function as a child was living in this kind of cocooned, safe world of the mortician's home. And people found that really creepy. I still run into people like, you were so creepy on that show, man. And I never thought of him as creepy at all, and maybe that's the key to playing a good creep, is I just thought of him as just pure-hearted, so pure-hearted that it hurt.
And you're also very formal in that character, in a way that people aren't anymore, like very good posture, very proper speech, you know, a cordiality and everything. So I want to play a scene from 6 Feet Under, and this is a scene. The family is preparing a funeral for a guy who is kind of like the head of a cult group or something, a polygamous cult group.
Mm-hmm.
And so you walk into the kitchen, and Ruth, who's the mother of the two grown sons who run the funeral home, she's preparing something in the kitchen. And you are very close to her. She's the only one who seems to understand you at all or be interested. And you've had this slightly flirtatious relationship, to which she's responded by giving you this big kiss. And this is like shortly after that. You walk into the kitchen, and the first thing you do is talk to her about the relatives of the cult leader who's being buried.
I've been talking with a couple of the people. They have some interesting beliefs.
They certainly believe in dairy. All the little ones beg for cheese.
Yes. Cows are sacred to them. Did you know they only recognize the love of God? They don't believe in romance.
Where did all those children come from?
We didn't get into it. But after all, romantic love wasn't even invented until the 14th century.
I never heard that.
Petrarch. He was Italian.
Arthur, the things you know.
This morning.
We don't have to talk about it.
Yes, we do.
We can pretend it never happened.
That would be a lie.
It was 2 seconds, a second and a half. I didn't plan it. It was an accident.
Your friendship has so much value for me. Anything more would be unprofessional.
I know.
Please, don't kiss me again.
I never will, never.
Friends.
Friends?
And that ended with the sound of Ruth giving Arthur a real big kiss.
Awesome.
Yeah. So what did casting people think of you based on your portrayal of Arthur in 6 Feet Under?
Well, that was really my first breakthrough role. I had been knocking around as an actor for quite some time. I did theater in and around New York for 8 or 9 years before I did any TV or film at all. And then I was kind of kicking around L.A. and doing guest spots and little things like that. And it, the funny thing about Arthur was that it was the fifth part I auditioned for on 6 Feet Under. And I kept not getting cast in a lot of very tiny roles. And I just kept kicking myself, like, oh, I want to be on this show so bad. And it all worked out for the best. But that really kind of put me on the map. That was at the time when HBO was, you know, must-see TV, and everyone was watching all the HBO shows. And, you know, I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to, you know, what I was capable of as an actor. And I'm so grateful for that part. And, you know, one of the great TV series and one of the really memorable characters on that series. And just really grateful.
Let's talk about your formative years growing up. You grew up in
Seattle, Washington, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I've read that you described your parents as hippies. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think, you know, I say hippies for lack of a better term, but they were more like beatnik bohemians than hippies. Because mm-hmm. you say hippies and people are like, oh, are they tripping all the time, dude? It's like, no, they were, they lived on a houseboat and my dad painted murals and wanted to be an abstract artist. And my mom at the time was actually an actress in like experimental theater and in Seattle, and she was painting her chest blue and running around topless doing Bertolt Brecht and stuff. They were kind of in that kind of world. And my mom wanted to name me Thucydides.
No.
After the famous Greek historian. So you could almost be talking to Thucydides Wilson, Terry. But my dad wanted to name me Rainier after Rainier Maria Rilke, the poet. And but we lived by Mount Rainier and blah, blah, blah. Somehow or other, I ended up with the name Rain. But, yeah, that was the late 60s in Seattle for you.
Were most of your friends' parents bohemians too?
No, we moved out to the burbs, and they were mostly like insurance agents and car salesmen.
So did that make you weird or your family weird by comparison?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just remembering the other day, like I would bring friends over and I'd be so embarrassed because my dad would have all of his huge oil paintings hung all over the house and he always painted like topless women. This seems to be a theme, doesn't it? There's like a boob theme woven in here. And I would be so embarrassed because my little friends would come over and they'd be like, what's that? I'm like, that's an abstract of a woman's boobs. Abstract oil after de Kooning.
Mr. Thucydides.
Yeah, so we were pretty weird, and I remember friends' parents would come over and try and sell us Amway, and we didn't really have any money or anything like that. My dad also was a struggling science fiction writer, and he'd pound away on his little manual typewriter writing kind of potboiler science fiction fantasy novels.
Were they good?
They're pretty good, yeah.
Published?
One of them got published, and I think there's like 11 of them in various shoe boxes around. He's even writing another one called, get this, The Zombies of Gog.
Oh, well, you were in a famous zombie film.
I was. House of 1,000 Corpses. Yes, indeed.
Directed by Rob Zombie.
Indeed, indeed. That was my first lead in a movie. You could say I was discovered by Rob Zombie. So
there's zombies running the family.
I think so. Yeah, zombies and boobs.
Well, if you felt different because your parents were bohemian, I imagine what would make you feel even more different is that your parents were of the or are of the Baha'i faith.
Yes.
And there's millions of people around the world who are of the Baha'i faith, but not a lot of them in the United States probably.
Not a whole lot of them. They say there's around 100,000 Baha'is in the United States. But yeah, so I grew up a member of the Baha'i faith as well. That was, you know, another thing.
What I know about the Baha'i faith is that people who practice Baha'i believe that all of the prophets from the different religions are all kind of from the same. That there's basically like one religion, and there you do it because I'm not going to get this right. So you
well,
do that.
It's hard to describe a major world religion in a nutshell.
Yes, right.
But
give us a paragraph about a major world religion.
If I could try, I would say that Baha'is believe there is only one God, and this unity guides all things. That this God is always revealing his message to humankind throughout the ages through various prophets or manifestations of God, and that all of these divine teachers kind of always refreshing and updating God's message, Zoroaster, Buddha, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, all of these men essentially have the same message when you look at the core of the message that they're bringing to humankind at that time. Their message is always co-opted and perverted by human interests, and that can make religion a great force of evil in the world. But if you go to the source, if you go to the words of God that these great men are revealing, there's always huge spiritual truths there. And Baha'is believe that there is a new divine teacher for this day and age dealing with the problems of our society right now, our world society, our global society. And that man's name is Baha'u'llah, and his name means the glory of God. And Baha'u'llah lived in Persia in the 1800s, and so Baha'is are followers of Baha'u'llah. But we're also followers of all the world's religions.
So your parents brought you up in the Baha'i faith. Mm-hmm. You left the faith for about 8 years and then returned. Why did you leave and why did you come back, if you don't mind my asking?
Not a problem at all. I love talking about it. I moved to New York City to become an actor and went to the grad acting program at NYU. And at that time, like so many people do in their early 20s, I was just like, the last thing I need right now is morality. I don't need God over my head. I don't want to live, you know, the way my parents taught me. I got to find this for myself. You know, living in Greenwich Village, and my religion in a way became theater and became acting. And it was all about kind of pursuing that path. And I will say that here's the great thing, another great thing about the Baha'i faith is there's a central teaching in the Baha'i faith, which is called the independent investigation of truth, in which all Baha'is, all people, are not only encouraged, obligated to find the truth for themselves, not to believe anything that anyone tells them, but to find it for themselves in their own way. So this path that I undertook was supported by the Baha'i faith, and my parents were like, great, you know, do what you need to do, and, you know, if you come back to the Baha'i faith, great. If not, great, you know, find your own way.
Now, I think, like, drinking and drugs is not something that you do if you're Baha'i.
Correct.
So on your eight-year hiatus from the religion, did you try that and say, well, what is it? Where does it lead? How does it feel? Will it free up my creativity? You know, all those things people wonder about.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely did, you know, just, you know, it's like those Amish kids, you know, and they give, I don't know the whole story, but they give them 6 months off and they're like, go for it, you know, here's some smack, you know, shoot up, go crazy. So I definitely went crazy for a long time there and, you know, explored all those things and you know, fortunately came out the other end, none the worse for wear, a little the worse for wear, but not too bad. And, you know, gradually kind of found my way back to my religious faith, which was a long kind of meandering journey.
Rainn Wilson, it has been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure.
I'm a really big fan.
Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks.
Rainn Wilson plays Dwight Schrute on The Office. He stars in the new movie, The Rocker. It opens August 20th. The Toronto-based band Sloan is one of Canada's most popular bands, but 17 years on, this quartet has yet to break through in the U.S. In 2006, Sloan released a 30-song album called Never Hear the End of It that's considered by many of its fans as the band's magnum opus. The group has followed this up with its shortest album to date, 13 songs gathered under the title Parallel Play. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Oh, Canada. Our neighbor to the north seems to either export superstars, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and Murray, or to send over bands that are just as good as many American acts, but which never quite break through commercially here. I'm thinking of an excellent country band like Prairie Oyster. No, I know, you never heard of them. And then there's the power pop with ambitions music made by Sloan, who offer irresistible melodies and hooks that America continues to find eminently resistible. I've got a way to think everyone around me is crazy. I've got a way to think everything that's bad gets worse. I've got a way to push it down deep inside me. Sloan is almost absurdly talented. All four members of the band each contribute individually written songs. They each play all the instruments in the band, thus allowing them to shift lead vocals and whoever wants to pound the drums or play lead guitar on any given song. Yet they also manage to maintain a signature sound. Sloan's style frequently harkens back to the close, chiming harmonies of the Electric Light Orchestra and the plaintiveness of Fleetwood Mac. Sloan may thus be slightly out of its time as far as music trends go, but that doesn't make a song like this new one, Witch's Wand, any less disarming. Remember, I've forgotten that I met you before. It was your friend, distant friend. I really got to know before you lived your witch's wand. Climb up to the roof so we can check out the view. I think somebody spoke, but I didn't have a clue that you lived your witch's wand. One reason Sloan may be dismissed as lightweights in this country is that, well, there's very little that's heavy about them. They're no good at sounding tough or menacing, as proven by one clinker here, Emergency 911, with its embarrassing attempt at a street cred refrain, quote, "I don't want no police round my door." On the other hand, they sure do know how to build a nice, big, billowing power ballad. In a way, after eight studio albums, this new one, Parallel Play, serves as a fine little introduction to Sloan music, an appetizer for anyone who wants to gorge on the 30-song power pop achievement of Never Hear the End of It from 3 years ago. Not to overstate cultural cliches about Canada, but there's something about Sloan's intrinsic modesty and politeness that may have contributed to their perceived slightness down here. But up in Toronto, they're probably holed up in a studio even as I speak, laying down tracks that will once again dominate their country's airwaves as I and a few other American fans wave at Sloan, fondly, wistfully, happy in our cult of admiration.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Marriage, missed opportunities, and miraculous art during hard times are the subjects that book critic Maureen Corrigan has been reading about lately. Here's her midsummer roundup of some notable works of biography and narrative history.
Here are the sure signs of summer in the publishing world. A heat rash eruption of suspense novels, a few waggish dog tales hoping to leash on to the continuing success of Marley and Me, and, as dependable as the days are long, some sweaty Bob's Big Boy-size biographies of Lincoln and FDR. other presidents seem more suited to the gloom of winter, but there's something about Lincoln and FDR, their steady shining through in adversity, that qualifies them as good company on vacation. Presidential biographies are classed as boy books by the publishing industry. That's another reason why the sagas of Lincoln and FDR often come out at the start of summer, Father's Day. But early summer this year saw the publication of a Lincoln book designed to appeal to both sexes, a kind of chick-lit Lincoln book, replete with shopping, sex, and scandal. The Lincolns by Daniel Mark Epstein is subtitled Portrait of a Marriage, and it excavates the character of poor Mary Todd Lincoln and her marriage of 22 years to the great man. Epstein is a respected biographer, and this is probably as well-researched as any account of the couple's life together could be, given the fact that so many letters were lost or destroyed. Here's Lincoln writing to Mary in April 1848 after he'd been elected to Congress and she had taken their two little boys and gone back to her father's house in Kentucky. Lincoln writes to her from Washington, D.C. Dear Mary, in this troublesome world, we are never quite satisfied. When you were here, I thought you hindered me in attending to business. But now, having nothing but business, no variety, it has grown exceedingly tasteless to me. I hate to sit down in this old room by myself. The Lincolns gives readers insight into Mary Todd's notorious rages, as well as her shopping sprees and Lucy Ricardo-like schemes to borrow money from the Treasury Department to help deck out the White House. Most poignantly, though, Epstein's biography offers a nuanced portrait of a relatively simple woman, unmoored by the sudden death of two young sons and by the necessary neglect of a husband called to an appointment with destiny. The troubled marriage at the center of Doris Lessing's autobiography/biography/novel called Alfred and Emily was certainly less melodramatic than the Lincolns, but devastating nonetheless to the daughter who observed it. Lessing explains in a foreword to this odd, mixed-genre book that she wanted to give her parents the lives they might have enjoyed if World War I hadn't intervened. Lessing, who was born in 1919, says, "That war, the Great War, the war that would end all war, squatted over my childhood. And here I still am, trying to get out from under that monstrous legacy, trying to get free." Part one of Lessing's book imagines her parents, Alfred and Emily, in separate but happier lives. Alfred as a farmer in England, married to a cheery blonde, Emily as an educational pioneer. Part two of the book describes the hardscrabble lives the couple actually led. A writer less chilly than Lessing would have made this book a sentimental what-if fantasy, but her fans know that although Lessing writes sci-fi, she never writes fairy tales. Marriage seems to be the prevailing subject of this review roundup, so I'll complete the theme by recommending a fascinating new book that describes a rare, happy marriage between art and government. Susan Quinn's Furious Improvisation details the history of the WPA's Federal Theater Project, a relief effort begun in the depths of the Great Depression to put thousands of actors and playwrights back to work and to lift the spirits of down-and-out Americans by putting on high-quality theater. From its inception in 1935 to its demise as a victim of the Red Scare, the Federal Theater Project helped launch the careers of Orson Welles and Arthur Miller, defiantly integrated theater audiences, and silenced naysayers who worried about government censorship of the theater. Quinn focuses on the two guiding spirits of the Federal Theater, Hallie Flanagan, its diminutive 46-year-old director, and blunt Harry Hopkins, one of FDR's top advisors, and her book is stuffed with goosebump-raising anecdotes. Listen, for instance, to how Harry Hopkins responded in 1935 to a hostile audience in Iowa City that demanded to know who was going to foot the bill for the WPA programs. You are, Hopkins told the crowd, and who better? Who can better afford to pay for it? This is America, the richest country in the world. We can afford to pay for anything we want. And we want a decent life for all the people in this country. And we are going to pay for it. It's hard to imagine that kind of tough talk from any politician, on the left or right, these days. I guess that since Quinn's book deals with the WPA, it distantly qualifies as a Roosevelt history. Lincoln and Roosevelt, the summer reading presidents. In a few months, we'll no doubt be turning our attention to the wintry likes of Harding and Coolidge.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage by Daniel Mark Epstein, Alfred and Emily by Doris Lessing, and Furious Improvisation by Susan Quinn. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.